Just at 10, it is 32 degrees right now in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. All this week, we have been rebroadcasting some noteworthy author interviews that were recorded and initially broadcast on the morning show during 2022. Today, we have several such interviews, beginning with one that was especially exciting for me to record, a conversation with Cody Keenan, who served for a time as head speechwriter for then-President Barack Obama. It's actually the third time in my years hosting the morning show that I have had the privilege of speaking with a presidential speechwriter. The occasion of this conversation with Cody Keenan was the publication of his wonderful new book called Grace, President Obama and 10 Days in the Battle for America. The subtitle refers to 10 especially dramatic days during the Obama presidency, when America was gripped in several different controversies and difficulties. For one, the country was reeling from a horrific mass shooting at a black church in Charleston, South Carolina. The country was waiting on pins and needles for important rulings to be handed down from the U.S. Supreme Court, one on marriage equality, the other on the Affordable Health Care Act. And much of the country was also embroiled in controversy and disagreement over whether or not it was still appropriate to fly the Confederate flag. Cody Keenan's account of how President Obama and key members of his staff grappled with these difficult issues is chronicled in this very, very interesting memoir published by Mariner Books. I think a lot of people are not going to know until they read your book, Grace, about the work that you did earlier in your career as an intern for Senator Ted Kennedy. What was most valuable about those years working for Senator Kennedy in terms of what you ultimately went on to do with President Obama?
That internship was my best learning experience, my best political learning experience. I was fresh out of college, opening letters in the mailroom and routing them to where they needed to go to get people help. And you read these letters, and it changes the way you think about politics. I mean, these are people not just from Massachusetts, but all over the country, writing to the last Kennedy brother to tell them about their lives, ask for help. And there's this real hope in those letters that even if someone's going through a tough time, somebody on the other side is going to read this and care enough to do something about it. And that changed the way I thought about politics forever. And even when I was writing speeches for President Obama, we would work in people's stories who wrote letters to him in the White House.
One of the chief themes in the book, as you get into your work with President Obama, is the matter of writing important speeches in moments of grief. Back in 2011, when you had to help write President Obama's eulogy delivered for the mass shooting where people were killed and Gabby Gifford seriously injured, and of course what we'll talk about in more detail, 2015, when a white supremacist murdered 8 worshipers and their pastor in a Charleston, South Carolina church. In those moments where a eulogy is being presented, which under normal circumstances would be an entirely personal outpouring, what is it like to have to sort of make it also something, at least in some ways, political, that speaks to important issues? What kind of a fine line does one walk when you are both writing and ultimately delivering a eulogy under those kind of circumstances?
You're absolutely right. I think for, you know, to be asked to give a eulogy is actually a pretty special honor to you're the one who's chosen to sum up somebody's life. It is rare, though, that you're going to have a battery of camera lenses staring at you and broadcasting it out into the world. That's where a president giving a eulogy is something different. And the way he always viewed it was, you know, we're here to sum up somebody's life, but I'm also here to bring up what are our obligations and responsibilities now that this person's gone. What do we do to carry on their life? What do we do to, unfortunately, prevent crises like these from happening again? And these are after mass shootings. And, you know, after Tucson, he didn't really go hard on guns in that eulogy. Newtown was a different story. After 20 little kids were murdered in their classrooms, along with six of their educators, you know, he wanted to signal in that eulogy that we were going to try to do something about this. And that not to politicize that is a political choice. Not to do something about guns is a political choice. And after Charleston, you know, you've got the added component of race. And he wanted to, he literally used the lyrics to Amazing Grace in that speech to say, listen, maybe we have been blind to the unique gun mayhem that gun violence inflicts on the country and the pain the Confederate flag stirs in citizens and how racism still infects every segment of our society. But we can open our eyes. Maybe we can see that now. And it's just kind of a beautiful way to do it.
Mm. You talk in your book about the really torturous process of crafting this eulogy for him to deliver in Charleston, a eulogy which initially he was very reluctant to deliver. I think at one point he kind of said, I've run out of words when it comes to talking about this, but ultimately was persuaded to do that. Would you share with our listeners that really touching moment when you ultimately apologized to President Obama, I think for the very first time in all the years that you had worked with him, over what you felt like you had at least to that point failed to do with this particular speech?
Yeah, if people think this book is self-promotion, they're going to be pleasantly surprised that it's not. It's hard to write for President Obama. It was always a struggle because he was better at it than we were, and he had really high expectations. But he also, the country had high expectations of him, which is why it was difficult. And he didn't want to give the Charleston eulogy at first, just because we had done so many. And after, you know, a background checks bill was defeated in the Senate a couple years earlier, he said, what am I going to do the next time this happens? You know, I don't want to be the one who just gives a eulogy and gives people permission to move on. After Charleston, it was what the families did by the families of the victims forgave the killer in this extraordinary act of grace. And that was ultimately what tipped him over into giving the eulogy. And I was struggling with it because, again, it touched on race and guns and the Confederate flag. And it's just a lot all at once to work into a speech while we were also working on speeches. The Supreme Court was poised to rule on Obamacare and marriage equality. You know, we were writing speeches for whether or not millions of Americans would lose their health insurance or be told they couldn't get married. And it was a lot. And I gave him a draft the night before. And he, for the first time ever, just drew a big line through the last two pages, just completely deleted them and rewrote them by himself in 3 hours. So that's why I apologized. It was the first time he'd done that to me, but it was the first time that I'd let him down like that. He did something cool. He put his hand on my shoulder and said, look, brother, we're collaborators. You gave me what I needed to work with here. You're going to recognize some of your work and what I did. And when you've been thinking about this stuff for 40 years, you'll know what you want to say too. And that's just kind of the kind of boss he was. You know, he didn't let me leave there feeling bad about myself.
Wow. I had the privilege of speaking with David Frum several years ago on this program, who was a speechwriter for the younger President Bush. And he talked in his book about the really significant challenge of trying to find the voice of the president for whom he was writing. I mean, to write words that would, even though he was writing them, would sound like President Bush's own words. And I suspect with President Obama was very much a similar kind of challenge, writing words that would feel right being delivered by President Obama and in his voice.
Absolutely. I mean, it took me a couple of years to truly get there. And the added difficulty to it is that I'm a white man, you know, who grew up in relative privilege on the north side of Chicago. And he's a black man who grew up not knowing his father and living all around the world. And we just had totally different life experiences. That doesn't make it any more difficult to get into somebody's head. I think race makes it a little harder because we just, there's just really no way to truly imagine what this country is like if you haven't lived it as a black person. But I would talk to him all the time. We would work before speeches. We'd sit. We'd really discuss, what are we trying to say here? You know, tell me about your experience. And that's really the job of a speechwriter, is not to put words into somebody's mouth, but to help them come up, to try to anticipate what they would write if they had the time. So I always spent a lot of time with him on the front end of a speech.
A last question, although I think people will be really interested to read about your relationship with President Obama. Some of the most interesting stuff in the book is also about the perpetual feedback you would receive from other staff members and advisors, and particularly those who would want certain elements inserted into speeches. What was that like? How frustrating was that to have that be sort of part of the machinery of creating these speeches for President Obama?
Yeah, it could be pretty frustrating when there are too many cooks in the kitchen. But, you know, at the same time, everyone had the same goal, which is to make the best speech possible. Sometimes people wanted to insert their own little bailiwicks into it, and that was a challenge. But everybody always had the same goal, and you'd remind yourself of that, whether it was the policy people or the fact checkers. You know, our fact checkers were really hard on us, and I ended up marrying one of them. And it was her job to give me a document every day that was meticulously sourced and cited to tell me why I was wrong, all the 20 different ways I was wrong every single day. And we're still married. So it all came from a place of love.
The book is Grace, President Obama and 10 Days in the Battle for America, and the author, Cody Keenan, head speechwriter for President Obama. Mr. Keenan, I loved your book, and thank you so much for giving me the privilege of speaking with you today.
Greg, it was all my privilege. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We are rebroadcasting some noteworthy author interviews that were recorded and initially broadcast during 2022. Here's part two of today's program. For part two of today's program, you're going to be hearing the interview I recorded last week with Steve Binder, an Emmy Award-winning producer, director, and writer, who is perhaps best remembered as the director and producer of one of the most exciting and memorable TV specials of all time, the Elvis Presley Comeback Special, which aired in 1968, without a doubt one of the greatest musical moments in television history. This special came along at a time when Elvis Presley had settled into a new life, not performing live in front of ecstatic rock and roll fans, but instead appearing in a long succession of mostly forgettable movies, which also had the effect of seriously blunting his image as a rock and roll icon. This TV special was a chance for Elvis Presley to return to his roots, although his chief handler, Colonel Tom Parker, wanted this to be a sentimental Christmas special. Fortunately, Steve Binder, the man assigned to produce and direct the program, had a much stronger concept in mind, and the special that was ultimately made was one of the most important nights of Elvis's career. Steve Binder has written a very interesting new book that takes us behind the scenes in the making of this groundbreaking special. The book is titled Elvis 68 Comeback, The Story Behind the Special, published by Thunder Bay Press. So, Steve Binder, we welcome you to the morning show. I'm so pleased to be able to talk with you about your fascinating book, Elvis 68 Comeback. One of the things that I learned from your book that I knew nothing about was that this very important and well-known Elvis special was part of a trilogy, that there had been a special called Hallelujah Leslie with Leslie Uggams, and then another special called Petula with Petula Clark, with special guest Harry Belafonte. Something happened on that special with Petula Clark that probably played a role in why you ultimately were offered this opportunity to work on this Elvis Presley comeback special. Could you just say a quick word about that controversial, important moment from that special?
Sure. Petula had written an anti-war song, and you have to realize in 1968, the war was raging on in Vietnam, and college students all across America were protesting the war. And so people were very, very sensitive to what was going on politically in the United States. Petula wanted to do a song she wrote herself about being against any war, not just Vietnam, but the whole concept that parents send their children to go fight these battles and die or are seriously wounded. And, you know, when the war is over, flowers grow on the same spot and people forget what actually happened. And NBC did not want me to program that song, but I convinced them that since Petula had written it and it wasn't about just Vietnam, that she should be allowed to perform it. So it ended up that we did it as a duet with Belafonte. And I staged it originally, and we had no audience watching, so I could do multiple takes. But originally, I had Petula coming downstage to Harry's backside after he had performed his segment on the show. And nothing was happening. And I'm an incredible believer that, you know, I don't care how much money you spend on a project, if it doesn't make an audience feel emotional, laugh, cry, do anything, you know, stand up and stomp the floor, you've wasted all your time and your effort and your money. And so I just felt organically it wasn't working. And I went down and restaged it and said, just, you know, when you come down, Petula, to Harry, instead of stopping behind him over his shoulder, which I loved as a director shot, I said, just stand shoulder to shoulder with him and sing the song. And then the magic happened. Then all of a sudden, Petula started to tear up. You could see it on the close-up. And Harry looked at her, and he saw her tearing up. And so his eyes got kind of watery. And the next thing you know, Petula reaches over and touches Harry's forearm in an emotional part of the lyrics. And all hell breaks loose with this. There's no other way to describe him, but he was a racist representative of the sponsor who objected to a black even being on this special. And as a result, he stormed out of the studio at NBC saying, this will never get on the air. So I went down to the editing room and erased all the other takes that I had done. So the only choice NBC and the sponsor had when they sang that duet was the moment where she reaches over and touches him. And that created an international barrage of press, including Time Magazine and Newsweek Magazine, who came to the studio just to take a picture of the touch off of the television screen. And that's what triggered NBC to make the phone call to me saying, we have a deal with Colonel Parker to do an hour television special with Elvis, but we can't get Elvis to do it. And we're thinking you're more the same age as him. You're in the music business with your partner, Bones Howe, and you're producing The Fifth Dimension and the Association hits. And you're working with Laura Nero now, and we think you'd make a good team with Elvis and yourself. I originally turned it down because I already made a commitment to an iconic 50s film producer, Walter Wanger, to do a movie that he sold to a studio. And so I thought I was kind of done with television. And my partner, Bones Howe, said, Steve, you're crazy. You and Elvis would hit it off great. I worked with him once, and I just think you guys would be a great team. And so I called back NBC and said, if you can arrange a one-on-one meeting with Elvis and myself, because I don't know him from Adam other than watching him on the Ed Sullivan Show and seeing him do these corny appearances on Milton Berle's show and Steve Allen's show, where in one case they had a real hound dog in front of him and dressed him up in a tuxedo. And that wasn't Elvis Presley. That wasn't rock and roll. And I understood him when I met him, and I said, you know, I understand you don't want to do television. He said, no. He said, Colonel Parker, when he made the deal with NBC, never told me I had to do a one-hour television special in order for them to release the monies to do my next movie, which turned out to be Change of Habit with Mary Tyler Moore. And so I said, okay, then, you know, what is your turf? And he said, my turf is making rock and roll records. And I said, then you make the rock and roll records, and I'll put pictures to them. How's that? You don't have to worry about the visual.
You know, one of the images you utilize in your book is when you say, "I told Elvis that we would approach his special like a tailor making a suit for a special customer because it was custom made. It would not fit any other artist, but it would be perfectly fitting for Elvis." You tell us in the book that Colonel Tom Parker had a very different idea about what this special should be compared to what actually aired in 1968. Briefly explain to our listeners what his idea was for what this special, this Christmas special, should be.
You know, Colonel Parker never cared about Elvis and his talent. He only cared about, you know, the checks that were coming into him for him to agree to let Elvis do whoever approached him in terms of their projects. And he told me when I first met him that when he saw Elvis, I think it was the Louisiana Hayride or something, he never looked at Elvis on the stage. He just looked at all the screaming young girls out in the audience, you know, going nuts watching him perform. And I think that was all the way through Elvis's relationship with Colonel Parker. I understand they had no social togetherness at all, never went to each other's home for a meal or anything. And I realized quickly after I met Colonel Parker that all he cared about was being the puppet master, pulling the strings. And I was amazed at how, you know, these major executives would kowtow to him and, you know, fear him. And he had nothing in his world that he could use to tempt me to do something I didn't want to do. And I think that really frustrated the colonel to begin with. And his game plan was, the first time I met him before meeting Elvis, he handed me a quarter-inch box with Elvis's picture on it. And it was his gift to disc jockeys all across America of Elvis singing 20 Christmas songs and not even speaking on the album. And I knew I didn't want to do that, leave it to Andy Williams and Perry Como and those Bing Crosby, those kind of guys, to do that. If I were to get involved with Elvis Presley, I wanted to see the real Elvis Presley, the people alluded to but never saw.
Right. And fortunately, of course, that's ultimately what became part of this amazing special. And your book is such an interesting look behind the scenes at what transpired, including what I think is a great idea that you share with us, the verbatim notes of some of the first planning meetings where you are throwing around all kinds of interesting ideas about what this special should be. Tell our listeners about a really important choice that was made. You asked Elvis Presley if he wanted anybody in particular to be involved in the making of this, and he asked for someone named Billy Strange to be, I don't believe, maybe the music director of this, and you agreed to that, although you had someone else in mind. You were happy to accommodate Elvis Presley's request. Ultimately, Billy Strange was fired from the project. Explain what went wrong with Billy Strange and the gentleman who stepped into his place and his reluctance to do so.
Well, it is an interesting story, especially behind the scenes. And what happened was, when I asked Elvis, because he was entering my world, I was not entering the Elvis world. I had my team all put together going back to when I directed my first Hullabaloo show in New York, where I met Gene McAvoy, our art director. I met Billy Goldenberg, who turned out to be our music director. And I asked Elvis, is there anybody special that you want to join our family? And he said, yes, there's one guy who, he's a guitar player, but he is my music guy, and his name is Billy Strange. And so I agreed, as much as I had in mind using Billy Goldenberg from the very get-go, I had in mind using Billy, I acquiesced and said, okay, I'll hire Billy Strange, which I did. And what I didn't know at the time is that Billy was working with Nancy Sinatra and produced this hit record for Nancy called These Boots Are Made for Walking. And his or Nancy's label insisted that they get back in the studio and finish the album so they could release it to the general public. So Billy Strange was totally tied up with Nancy Sinatra while I was pre-planning bringing Elvis in to start rehearsals at my offices on the Sunset Strip to start rehearsing for his own special. And every day I would call Billy Strange and say, where are the lead sheets? Where's the music that Elvis is going to be rehearsing to? And he'd say, don't worry, it'll be there, it'll be there. And I finally gave him a deadline and an ultimatum. If the music isn't there on such and such a day, I'm firing you. And he said to me, you can't fire me. I'm closer to Elvis Presley. You just met him. You don't even know him. And so that deadline came and went, and I fired him. And Colonel Parker went bananas as usual and said, you know, I'm not sure Elvis is even going to show up to do your special now, Steve. And actually, he called me Bindle. Don't ask me why, but that was his nickname for me when he was upset with me. Hmm. And as a result, you know, I called Billy Goldenberg, who I had worked with on Hullabaloo, and he had been musical director for me on the Leslie Uggam special, on the Petula Clark Belafonte special. And Billy said, Steve, I'm a New York kid. As a teenager, he was ghostwriting with Frank Lesser, the great Broadway writer who wrote Guys and Dolls and Green Willow and so forth. And he said, I'm a Jewish kid from New York, and I just don't see myself conducting Hound Dog or Blue Suede Shoes. I said, Billy, I'm not asking you. I'm begging you. I'm on my hands and knees. Come to Los Angeles immediately and do the Elvis Presley special.
And fortunately, he did. And it was all incredible magic. It's all in incredible what was put together. And again, your book takes us behind the scenes of the shaping of this wonderful special in which, in your words, Elvis Presley rediscovered himself. I want to give you a chance to talk about, quickly, I know we're almost out of time, about those iconic improv moments where we see Elvis Presley, in a sense, in a jam session, making music spontaneously. Explain to our listeners what your inspiration was for including this in this groundbreaking special.
When we finally moved out to NBC to start actually taping the show and continue our rehearsals with the dance companies and Elvis and so forth, it was really a situation where Elvis came to me and he said, Steve, do you think you could throw a bed into my dressing room? Because rather than commute to a rented home in Beverly Hills where Petula 3 months earlier had given birth to Lisa Marie, I would really like to live out here and save those few hours of travel time so I could focus and devote it to the special. That was the greatest thing that ever happened, because when we would finish taping or rehearsing, he'd go into his dressing room. We had a couple of pianos in there, and whoever was hanging out would wander in, and he would jam until, you know, midnight or 2 a.m. or whatever, just reminiscing about the old days, and everybody was participating and telling old stories about, you know, when the Vice Squad was at the Pan Pacific Auditorium in California and waiting for him to wiggle his hips so they could arrest him, and stories like that that were really fun. And I said, this is the real show. This is the magic. This is the platinum, double platinum, triple platinum, recording. And so I went to the colonel, and I said, I'm bringing cameras into the dressing room to film this. And the colonel said, typically over my dead body, you know, you're not bringing cameras in there. But I knew I had to get this on tape, so I kept hounding the colonel to the point of where, out of frustration, I think, not thinking I would do it, he actually said, okay, if you want to recreate it one day out on stage, I'll let you do that, but I won't guarantee I'll put it into the show. And by that time, he had lost so many battles, you know, still screaming for his Christmas songs. And So it was really a case of where I don't know any other artist, including all the artists I've worked with, that could cold turkey just walk out and do a real improvisation, not a phony one. In fact, my writers ran home when they heard I was doing it and wrote a script for Elvis. And I said, that script is not improvisation. I want Elvis to go out there and not give him a roadmap even. He gets to choose whatever songs he wants to sing. He gets to tell the stories he wants to tell. Elvis asked me to bring DJ Fontana and Scotty Moore, his original drummer and guitarist, in for it. And I think when we started the improv, Elvis was terrified to the point where he wanted to back out. I wouldn't let him. And it was a case of once he got into it and they started really improvising, he forgot he was doing television. He was just having a great old time like the old days with DJ and Scotty and really having fun, where it became a cliche where I almost had to get the vaudeville hook and pull him off the stage. I think he would have stayed out there forever continuing to jam, which it really was. And there was no roadmap. There was no rehearsal. It was pure, honest Elvis that proved to even all of his peers that he was truly the king of rock and roll.
And we are so grateful for all the great work you did on this important special. The Elvis 68 Comeback and this book from Thunder Bay Press tells the full story. Steve Binder, thank you so much for giving the world not only this special, but this wonderful book about it. Thank you so much, and thank you for being my guest today on The Morning Show.
Thank you. I appreciate it very much.
You're listening to The Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Here's a third and final noteworthy author interview that was recorded and initially broadcast during 2022. And I am exceptionally excited about the interview that you are about to hear, because it is about a stunningly beautiful and fascinating book called Apollo Remastered, The Ultimate Photographic Record. This magnificent book, which really needs to be seen to be fully believed and appreciated, captures an extraordinary array of photographs and stills from film that chronicle most specifically the Apollo missions that took human beings to the moon, and also some interesting photographic artifacts, if you will, from some of the missions that predated Apollo. And these are images seen in a clarity never before experienced. And the man responsible for this amazing book is Andy Saunders, who has done all kinds of groundbreaking work in the art of remastering photographic images. And the result of his loving work is this amazing book published by Black Dog and Leventhal. Again, Apollo Remastered, The Ultimate Photographic Record. Andy Saunders, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Well, thanks for having me on, Greg. Good morning.
One of the things that's important for our listeners to understand is the sort of unprecedented nature of what they get to see in this book. In terms of, in certain cases, images that have never really been seen before by the public, and in many other cases, images that we have seen, but not in the way that we see them in this book. Explain that important distinction.
Yeah, well, I mean, the start of the project, one of the reasons was my frustration with the quality of what we've always seen. And it didn't really make any sense, because they used the best cameras, the best film, the best photo lab. You know, we should have always been seeing them in a better state. So when I looked into this, the key reason is the original film. So this is the film that was actually in the cameras on the moon. Once they got back from the moon landings, that original film, it's so delicate and so important, you don't want to handle it more than once. So they didn't. So they processed it, they made a master duplicate copy, and then the originals went into this frozen vault in Building 8 in Johnson Space Center, and they remain there pretty much untouched for half a century. And everything we've seen since has been based on the duplicates, or copies of duplicates, or copies of copies. And at every copy, there's a degradation in quality. So that's one of the reasons that we've never been able to see them in their best state. But that film, that original film, has finally made it out of the frozen vault and has been digitally scanned to an incredibly high resolution. A resolution whereby everything that's in that film is captured in these digital scans. So in applying the latest digital processing to that, which you have to do because these scans, if you think of it, they're effectively a digital photograph of a piece of film that's in a camera. So and that's the other thing that hasn't happened before is we've taken lower quality scans and people just, I don't know, turn the brightness up and put them on online or print them. But you can't do that with analog film, with a digital scan of analog film. You have to digitally process it. So that's what I've done. With the original flight film, I've also utilised an unusual stacking technique on the 16mm film and just been able to bring out detail that we've never been able to see before. Mm.
You tell us in the foreword to the book that you looked carefully inspected 35,000 images in order to select, in your words, those which most effectively represent the Apollo program. Can you just take us inside that process? I mean, what sorts of things were you looking for that would, in your words, most effectively represent Apollo and its accomplishment?
Yeah, it was incredibly difficult. I mean, the concept of this of the book, it isn't just those remastered, you know, the fact that something was really poor and kind of, ta-da, look at how nice it is now. It's not a gimmicky book. There are those moments in it, but the concept is it's the ultimate or definitive photograph record of the whole of Apollo. And so, firstly, there needs to be images from every mission, from Apollo 7 through to Apollo 17. Also, they need to tell the story of each mission. So I researched every photograph and worked out exactly when it was taken, who took it, what is it that we're looking at, what point in the mission is it, and what the astronauts saying at the time that they witnessed these incredible vistas. Hmm. So that they, as well as putting each image into context, they also help, like say, tell the story of the whole program. Hmm. So images that help to do that, and in terms of out of those 35,000, you know, anyone that's put any family photo album together from the favorite vacation will appreciate it can be hard. So imagine when you've got 35,000 of the most incredible things humans have ever seen. It was an incredibly difficult process. But there are different types of images. There are images that have historical significance. There are images that reveal something we've never been able to see before. There are images that just instantly convey the awe-inspiring nature of human space exploration. They just hit you. It's just an incredible vista. There's also panoramic shots. So they took sequences of photographs, and I've enhanced those and stitched them together. And they're great at just being able to convey the grandeur and scale of a lunar landscape. And also, particularly if they've got a person in them. And that's the final key. That's the one really important thing I wanted to get across in the book is to show the human side. We tend not to see it. They didn't tend to take photographs of each other, so that they're quite rare. When we do, what we've often seen is, you know, an anonymous figure, a puffy white spacesuit and a gold visor. Hmm. And what I want to do is be able to maybe see through the visor, look through the windows, and also to be able to step on board the spacecraft and almost ride along with these space explorers. Hmm. So a combination of all those types of images and also ones that tell the story of the program made it into the book. But there's 400. So, you know, it's a big book. I don't know if you've had a copy. It's a big, heavy book.
Yes.
and there's over 400 images in it. So that's a good opportunity to get a good spread of every mission.
Absolutely. One of the things I applaud you for, many things, but one of the chief things I want to applaud you for is that it seems to me that somebody who is in your business of working with photographs and trying to achieve the most exquisite sort of perfection, I could imagine someone in your position gravitating towards only those photographs that in a sense are of pristine perfection and you showing grandeur and so on. I so appreciate the fact that your book is not just that, but also a certain number of photographs that are sort of fuzzy and in a sense imperfect, but they are some of the most fascinating images in this book. Just to highlight one that I'll have you talk about, there's a really interesting photograph from Apollo 11, which is taken from the lunar module, pointed down at the surface, and we see stuff that has been, in a sense, thrown out onto the surface of the moon at the foot of the ladder. Explain this interesting image. I'm so glad it's there.
Yeah, it's actually something I didn't know existed. I didn't know we could see. It's actually Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin's PLSS, or the backpack. So at the end of the mission, when they got back into the lunar module, they left all kinds of things behind on the moon, including the Hasselblad camera, much to my dismay. But they had to minimize, so they can maximize sample return of rock, they had to leave stuff behind. So anything that they really didn't need was kind of tossed overboard. So, yeah, once they got back in the lunar module, they connected up to the systems in the spacecraft, opened the hatch, and they kind of pushed out the backpacks that obviously kept them alive on the lunar surface, and they tumbled down the ladder and landed at the foot of Eagle, at the lunar module. And they took some 60mm film. It was very underexposed, but with this stacking technique and enhancing it and bringing out the shadow detail, we can now see those two backpacks lying on top of each other. And you're right, it's not a great quality image, but it's such a poignant one. It's, you know, that's how we would, if you went back to the landing site, to Tranquility Base, that's how we'd find it.
Hmm.
You know, this permanent memorial to one of the greatest ever human achievement.
Right. A very poignant image, speaking of memorials, comes from Apollo 15 and a photograph that Dave Scott took of something which he left on the surface of the moon. And the caption of the photograph suggests that this is something that the folks back home, that is at NASA, did not know was going to occur. Would you mind telling our listeners about this beautiful memorial that Dave Scott elected to leave on the lunar surface?
Yeah, they took a little kind of piece of artwork. It was a little sculpture, and it was named The Fallen Astronaut. And alongside that, he left a small plaque with the names of people who had lost their lives from the Russian side as well as the US side in the pursuit of reaching the moon, including, of course, most poignantly, perhaps those from the Apollo 1 fire. So there's a list of all the names, and he photographed that with the fallen astronaut in the lunar dust as a permanent memorial to those people. Mm. Back home, they didn't know. So actually, Mission Control, when you read the transcripts, when I was researching this, they said, Dave, what are you doing now? And he basically said, oh, we're just tidying some things up near the rover. He's kind of out of shot of the camera, and that's actually what he was doing, as he was laying this memorial and taking the photograph.
And I just think it's so beautiful that that plaque contains the names of both fallen astronauts from the United States and fallen cosmonauts from the then Soviet Union. I just think that is in and of itself such a beautiful aspect of that. You mentioned the fact that these photographs are preserved in a way and presented in chronological order, at least to at whatever extent it is possible to know that. I'd never stopped to think about actually how complicated a matter that would be. Can you just briefly explain the challenge of trying to figure out when a given photograph was taken in the course of a mission in order to present them in chronological order?
Yeah, well, the issue lies in the fact that they took multiple magazines. Of course, this is film, so it's not like digital cameras where everyone was numbered. It was rolls of film in magazines, up to 200 per magazine, multiple cameras. So although you know the order within a magazine, they're clearly chronological. They may take 10 from that magazine, and then someone else may be taking with another camera the next six with their camera and their magazine. So that's the complexity to work it out. I mean, I understood the missions. I understood the chronology of what they were trying to achieve. So that helped. There's resources online. There's studying the transcripts of what they were saying at the time. Even went to the lengths of, for example, with the 60mm film, there's no indication at all when in the mission that was. But, for example, the camera may pan past the mission counter. There was a mission timer in the command module that was started at launch, and so that gives you the hours, minutes, and seconds from launch to whatever point they filmed it. So that was a clue. I had a great time on Zoom with Rusty Swikart looking at Apollo 9, and we were looking at that film and even saying, well, given how much stubble is on his crewmates, that indicates, you know, how many days into the mission we may be.
Wow.
So there's a whole host of information. Even the photograph, you can tell the which window it was taken out of, and therefore who is in that position on the spacecraft to work out who took it. So it was, yeah, a combination of lots of different factors, and it wasn't a straightforward process.
Your book includes the famous photograph known as Earthrise, from that first time we were to the moon and looking back at the planet Earth rising above the horizon of the moon. But your book, most remarkably, actually contains a photograph taken right before the so-called Earthrise photograph, yeah. One of the most famous photographs ever taken. This other one is, in some respects, still more beautiful. Briefly explain its inclusion in the book.
Yeah, I'm glad you pointed that out. Yeah, most people assume that the Earthrise color shot is the first photograph of Earth from the moon. But in fact, you're right, there was a black and white one, or a couple of black and white ones taken just before. And that was all part of the scramble. So again, in researching this, the crew of Apollo 8 had actually made three orbits before they even noticed Earthrise because the orientation of the spacecraft. Then when Bill Anders noticed it through the window, he was, you know, you can hear it in his voice. He's like, oh my God, look at this. We have to get this photograph. And he only had black and white. So he started to take on black and white. And in the meantime, he's shouting to his crewmate, you know, get me a roll of colour quick. And I think it was Jim Lovell that finally found the roll of colour. They got that on the camera. And then he got the Earthrise shot. So the colour one was second and, of course, more famous. But actually, there was a black and white one taken just a little earlier.
Mm, wonderful. Apollo 9's Rusty Schweikert says we should take this book and read it in darkness in order to fully appreciate these beautiful images. And again, it's a magnificent book. Apollo Remastered, the Ultimate Photographic Record, and responsible for it, Andy Saunders. Mr. Saunders, thank you so much for giving the world this extraordinary book. What a beautiful accomplishment. Thank you so much, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thank you again, Greg. Thank you.
I want to mention a couple of other interesting photographs that are part of this book called Apollo Remastered. As we touched on very briefly in the conversation, the book contains not only photographs from the Apollo missions, but also a few photographs from the Mercury and Gemini programs. There is, for instance, a beautiful photograph of the Earth taken during Alan Shepard's suborbital flight back in 1961, the first time a photograph was taken that showed clearly the curvature of the Earth. There's also a photograph from John Glenn's flight, the first orbital flight around the Earth, in which he took a picture with a camera that he bought at their local dime store. So an imperfect photograph, but a precious memento from that historic occasion. The book includes the first selfie ever taken in space by Buzz Aldrin back in 1966. And there's an even more extraordinary so-called selfie taken during Apollo 9. Extraordinary because it includes the images of all three astronauts in the command module. It's one of the only instances in which we see such a sight. There are all kinds of other beautiful images that are part of this amazing book. Again, it is titled Apollo Remastered, the Ultimate Photographic Record. Each chapter begins with text with the headline, The Mission, in which Andy Saunders outlines the purpose and schedule of each mission, what was hoped to accomplish, what in fact was accomplished, and of course the names of the astronauts for each mission are included as well. And every photograph, all 400, include a caption which tells us who took the photograph and what that photograph represents. The book is published by Black Dog and Leventhal Publishers. I highly recommend Apollo Remastered. It's a beautiful way to commemorate the 50th anniversary of Apollo 17, the last mission that NASA made to the moon.